Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
Now, yesterday we spoke about the situation at the Barberton and the situation of illegal mining there. We spoke to David van Wyk. We also spoke to the spokesperson of the MEC of safety in Mpumalanga. One of the things that we did not talk about is how this is affecting the workforce in that mine, right? So it's a different scenario here. It's not like Stilfontein where they're going into an area where the mine has been abandoned, for instance. This is a mine that's currently operating. And while it is, there's another kind of a syndicate, sort of, that is going in there in the dead of the night and doing their illegal operations in the same mine. So it complicates matters a little bit. And I wanted to understand how this affects, number one, the workforce there and what it actually means. I had a conversation earlier, offline though, it wasn't going to be on air, with the management there. And they were speaking about how if this continues, they are saying they are arresting about 150 people a week. This has been how they've been operating that mine for the past year. They eventually get themselves to a point where they need to get SAPS to assist them because they've been trying to do this and they are not coping. It's not sustainable. They're not coping. But they are also threatening that if this continues, they'll just leave. They'll just stop operating in the mine and they'll just close it off and no one will have a job. So I do think it's something to talk about. Attorney and Lawyers for Human Rights, Mametlwe Sebei, is on the line with us. I really appreciate you taking your time to talk to us this evening. Thank you so much. Good evening and welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Pamela, and always,
What's your take on what's happening at the Sheba Mine near Barberton?
Well, I mean, a situation that we've always spoken about in terms of the explosive and an unregulated artisanal mining that I think unfortunately is spilling over, as you correctly pointed out, to existing operation at a great peril to even miners that obviously are regularly employed in those particular mines. Because let's understand what this means. You can't have two groups of miners operating without any coordination underground because it poses a serious risk.
Yeah.
You know, with a group of miners blasting that side, the other one blasting that side. Mm. I mean, you know, the enormity of the risks that are involved cannot be overstated. Mining is already a dangerous occupation on it by itself, adding another layer of complication that flows from lack of coordination in the planning, including blasting and, of course, mining of certain areas. The usage of the pillars to, hold the ground and all of that is just an unimaginable exacerbation of the risk that are ordinarily involved. And I think it's not sustainable.
Mm.
And the issue is, one, obviously, it speaks to the other issues. I mean, I was here and I think I made a point when we were talking that there are two levels to this. There are disparate people and miners that unfortunately are being exploited by organized syndicate.
Mm.
And one of the things and conversation that I had is that for me, a definition of that syndicate is that, the tops of, if you like, the social pyramid, of these operations. And one of the things that I was insistent about is that this is not possible without the involvement, one, of the mine security company, two, of the police. Now, what Barberton highlights is the role of the mine security company,
mm-hmm.
because it cannot be that miners on the scale of 100 can enter an operating mine without some form of involvement of mine security companies. Mm. So if Barberton highlight the role of the, you know, mine security companies, Stilfontein does confirm the role of the police, right?
Mm.
The only other remaining pieces in the puzzle is the issue of the role of the mining corporation that have the license to trade on these minerals in the international market.
So for me, the issue is complicated by that, because they've been all sorts of things to change the management in the security company. They've tried to change the companies themselves. It's been on and on and on and on. They're now at a point where they're saying, well, you know, we can't do this anymore. It's not sustainable. We had a 30-year plan. But we can't. If we are operating alongside a syndicate that is doing illegal mining, we cannot do this. Where does this leave us? And I ask you this, Ntatasibeyi, because you've been quite involved in these disputes and these issues, especially with abandoned mines and all of that. But in a scenario like this, you know, how do we take this forward?
So for me, the solution, as I said, in the time is very simple. One, there is socio-economic issues. We have got to address the plight of the millions of people who are unemployed, many of them in these mining communities. Any other means of making a living other than work in these horrific conditions that endanger themselves, I mean, that endanger them, but also the fellow miners that are also working underground, as well as, of course, you know, communities as a thing and so on. We've got to address that. And I think solutions are very simple. I mean, you know, I pointed out there's over 6,000 mines that are abandoned and derelict. Mm. Over 2,300 of those still have substantial minerals to be mined, you know, sustainably. The idea that we're going to be waiting for some investors from America, China, Canada, Australia to come and give us money when we have capital, it is there at IDC. State of the Nation address after another. They recycle the same money as been promises to address unemployment. Why is those mines can be expropriated? And in any event, because they are derelict, automatically by law and, you know, they by default, they belong to the state. And because there's not anyone who owns the mining right, and of course, you know, the Minister of Minerals is a custodian of the mining rights that is a property of the common property of the people of this country.
Mm.
So the state needs to expropriate those particular operations, capitalize them, and create the hundreds of thousands of jobs, which if those minerals are also beneficiated locally, we can also create many more millions, you know, rural development, and of course, begin to reindustrialize the country and solve many of our problems. So that's one level. The other level is obviously that, you know, because once you have dealt with that, you are then able to isolate the extremely violent organized criminal syndicate, which, as I have said, you know, at the tops of the structure, it is obviously the private security companies.
Mm.
It is obviously, you know, not just your low-level constables.
Mm, mm.
You are talking about general. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Mm.
It is also about the mining corporations that have the license to trade on this.
Mm-hmm.
So this mine, I mean, the outsourcing of their own security is part of the problem, right? For them, it's about expectation of security services and security personnel dividing the miners. But the reality is that, you know, people in that industry, there is a very thin line between criminal enterprises and many of these security operations. And unfortunately, that also extends to SAPS, as I think the whole, Commissioner Mkhwanazi revelations confirm, what you always know. So, but I think the mine in sourcing and, of course, being accountable for their own security would go a long way in the first instance. Secondly, it is also obviously to ensure that there is coordination, quite correctly, with the police that also need to be held accountable, because they are part of the problem.
Mm.
There's no doubt in my mind. Just look at the sheer scale of that operation, right? And tell me, how can that be secretive to the law enforcement. Because it's one thing when you say two, three people have sneaked into the mine. When is a big mine, that I can understand. But hundreds of them, there must be some explanation.
Yeah.
And that is not possible without securities and police involvement. So we there's a lot of things that need to be done. But I think ultimately, we also need, in my view, we have been campaigning, and I mean, I'm talking about my other capacities now. Mm-hmm. Nationalize the mining industry. Make sure that you address and you smash the entire networks of illicit trading on mine, because we are talking about the activity of these artisanal miners, but we forget that they are mainly feeding into network of illicit flows of financial resources into the minerals that UN Convention on Trade and Development says is about $62 billion US dollars worth of illicit flows annually. That is over $1 trillion. So lots of them is done through a big corporation that have monopolized vast sections of the economy.
Could it be too late? In the sense, I don't think that the community is naive about an operation like this that's going on that could essentially jeopardize the jobs of those who do have a job in that mine. And so I'm sure somebody's thinking about this. But, you know, you have to weigh up the odds. Is it a situation where, well, once I've tasted the, you know, the fruit, I'm not going to go back. I actually don't want to work because I can earn more doing this illicit work. So could it be too late where the system has become so, it's systematic, right? And it's endemic, that it may be too difficult and too late to reverse all of this now and get it back on track?
You're spot on. I mean, the reality is that this is a bitter fruit of a colonial mining that I think I've spoken about, the key element of which is obviously, as I've said, cheap migrant labor, where, as you correctly point out, it's basically slavery. And the appalling conditions of miners incentivize. I mean, many of them look at, can I make more money? I mean, look at the situation now. The price of gold has increased astronomically. We had, a bullish market in the platinum industry a few years ago. With Anglo Platinum making as much as $79 billion in profit, almost 3-4 times than what they expected. They just paid out all of that money to their shareholders, leaving nothing for the workers and so on. So mine workers see these things. And even when the industry is really swimming in massive amounts of profits, those are not shared equitably because this is an industry addicted to the enslavement, a colonial slavery of the black working class, but also that extractivism that we've spoken about, where basically this country for these multinationals is no more than a quarry to extract with a cheap labor, the raw materials to be exported without any form of economic development. I mean, I've listened to interviews of the miners. One of the things that struck me about Barberton is the way even the formerly employed miners are very sympathetic to those miners.
Wow.
And it's very clear to me that many of them is obviously their former colleagues, and many of them is their brothers and sisters in communities. And that demonstrates the gulf between our perception and if you like, prejudices of what is really happening in these communities and the reality on the ground and how these miners are seen. We've seen the same phenomenon in Stilfontein, where people in big shops, by the way, I mean, managers of big commercial shops, and you go there and say, look, the people talking on radios, they don't know what is happening here. Without this artisanal mining, the economy of Stilfontein will collapse. Those are stories we're hearing. That struck me about Barberton. And that's the reason I'm saying we need to find a sustainable solution to this. Precisely so that we can isolate, you know, organized criminal syndicates that are extorting from these miners, that are ruthlessly exploiting them, that are responsible for the reign of terror, for all the murders, the rapes, and the violence that our communities, our families, are rightfully concerned and agreed about. And we'll be able to, you know, uproot that companies among the police, and indeed among our political establishment and the corporate elite that are clearly complicit in these crimes.
So, what do we do now? You know, what do we do tomorrow? What do we do next week? I can't imagine that the SAPS is going to be there forever. In fact, I can't imagine that they're going to be there for a year. It's clear the mine itself is saying, well, we can't seal it off. It's not possible. We need the ventilation. It's not like a non-operating mine. So what happens now? How do we manage this entire thing and save jobs?
I mean, I can tell you, I mean, general, part of the reason why we're in this conversation is not just the dreams of the mining industry for the reason that I've mentioned.
Yes.
Look at the industry, right? The profits of the industry in the past decades, I mean, I've seen the report from Alcoa that says they've increased their profits by 4,900% in the past 30 decades. Just in the past 5 years, they've doubled their earnings. Mm. So how are they doing that? And they are introducing mechanization, obviously in raising productivity. Mm. Instead of lowering the working hours, sharing the job amongst the workforce in a way that obviously, because technology is supposed to be making our lives very easier, right? And what are they doing? They are massively slashing jobs, creating massive unemployment. So it's all well and fine for me and you to say, well, let the police move in, let them, I mean, arrest. The question is, how many people are going to get arrested, right? And it's very easy to say, well, there are migrants and so on, having that problem. And I think I was saying it, you know, last night on the interview, is that I don't know why in the media this discussion is not featured. One, mining industry has always been built by the migrant labor from the whole of Southern Africa. That is the mainstay of the labor regime by the mining company. Nobody is confronting that. Those are the agreements concluded by the British colonial governments in this country and apartheid, of course, with the Portuguese colonial regimes in Mozambique and so on, the Lesotho and so on. And South African government to this day is renewing those agreements. Look at their memorandums of understanding with Mozambique, with Lesotho, about the use of the labor force. Why do we seem shocked that these migrants are in these particular mining communities and nobody ever questioned this memorandum of understanding? So that for me surprises me that we're not having that conversation, right? And one of the things, Pamela, just to say, that struck me was, I mean, when I organized in the mining and the workers from Mozambique were complaining still about not getting the money.
Yeah.
They're getting one third of the money. And
not
I said,
their pensions.
Why?
Yeah.
So the money, no, in terms of the way they have been paid by
Teba.
They have been paid one third of the money here. The other money has to be paid in Mozambique.
Yes.
And what kind of regime is it? Well, it's an agreement that was concluded between apartheid South Africa and the Portuguese colonial government.
Yeah.
And the democratic government still has the system in place. How scandalous and criminal is that? So people are talking about this migrant visa, but nobody wants to have conversation about that. But I think also the point I'm making is that they have been boosting their massive profit by incredibly reducing the amount of labor that has created a devastating levels of poverty and unemployment in these communities needlessly. And I think it is that crisis that I think we are reckoning with, and we have got to accept police can only go so far with the socioeconomic crisis in that situation.
So if everybody in principle agrees with what you're saying, and we've actually had this conversation with other people, David Van Wyk has come in, we keep harping on the same thing. We are not dealing with how we got here in the first place, how these migrant workers came in as part of an agreement that dates back to apartheid days. if everybody agrees that we are here now because of systems and agreements that were actually unfair to the African body, why is it then that we don't seem to come out with a solution quick enough? So in our speeches, we're saying the right things. But why do you believe we're not getting to the point of solving these problems? Number one, of making sure that there is proper rehabilitations of mine, rehabilitation of mines that are done and dusted with their mining, or training of artisanal miners and making sure that that law goes through and quickly does that. And all of these other problems. Why do you think we're not getting there quickly enough? Because we've been saying the same things and we're hearing the same things from people like yourselves.
It is because, and this is something that you've got to understand about the political economy of the state formation in this country, that, you know, since you are Anglo-Boer, the Union of South Africa, the state in this country has not only been a capitalist state in a way that every state under capitalism is. This is a mining capitalist state. So when you really talk about a capture of the state, the articulation of the interest between the state and, of course, the mining monopoly capital. This is the most crude an example of it. So there is just generalized impunity, you know, of the mining company. I mean, government, look at the kind of excuses that they give. They will tell you, well, we have about 6,000 abandoned mines. Why? Because of the old legislative framework that used to be there and other things and so on. I mean, I'm sorry to say that is Hogwarts terminology, because I'll tell you why. No matter what you think about, and quite correctly so, right, about your Boer republics of Transvaal and Orange Farm, what those and Orange and you know Free State, what those republics were, racist, reactionary as they were, those were farmer states. So when industrial mining commenced, from the beginning they took legislative measures to protect their primary constituencies, that is the farmers. So we always had a strong regulatory framework requiring the mining industry to rehabilitate and to manage the environment in a manner that is sustainable for those interests. But we just also had to look at to you know what has happened even after the passage of NPRDA, NEMA, and other things. I mean, the research that I did, just that I don't have the figures immediately with me, but I remember the research that I did about the mine closure shows that between 2011 and 2016, 87% of the mine closure certificates were relating to prospecting and exploration, right? And only 13% were actually mine closure certificates for mining permits, and even that, the overwhelming majority of them were Western Cape, which is just the requiring of sand, right? There were no closure certificates for provinces like, you know, Free State, Gauteng, and Mpumalanga, if I recall, and I think one for Limpopo or something like at a time when the mine companies are closing. And that's not surprising. And government is allowing it. I'm dealing with a case, let me tell you now. There's a mine called what was that platinum? It's in Blue Ridge Platinum Mine, right? It used to be owned by Paras, it's owned by Sibanye. Mm. Sibanye is selling that mine to a company that has been chucked out of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. It has lost soon after trying to lift over 90% of their value. They have sold the mine for 100 rand, right? And the Minister of Mineral Resources has approved that. Let me tell you what is the real object of their trade.
Mm-hmm.
Is that that company will take over the responsibility
mm-hmm.
for environmental debt.
Mm.
That is the debt of rehabilitation and closure.
Mm.
That is approximately, I think it's 92 million for rehabilitation and over 25 million for care and maintenance before. So they know there's no prospect of that new company actually sustaining and even properly closing that mine. That the minister even has approved, it's just criminal. Let's be blatant. It's just pure criminality, right? These are things that we are having. Now, we are talking, the legislative framework is there. They are talking about enforcement. But the reality is that from the top to the lowest officials in the DMRE, you are talking about people who in DMRE just see DMRE as a stopover for real employment in the mines and so on. So from the receptions and to the director there, you know, when the mine boss, you know, enter that space, they just see a prospect of employment because that's where they'll probably get millions that the state will never be able to pay them. In addition to the fact that their politicians, including the president of this country, has become rich, not by ever obtaining any business or anything. I mean, how did he become a billionaire? That is, he was bought, no doubt about it, right? And you know, and you know, the Marikana, it was a collection on that debt. The Stilfontein Day, it was protection of the monopoly of mining capital over the right to exploit the minerals. They were prepared to starve the miners to death just so that they put a blood stop to artisanal mining instead of engaging its proper regulation, as well as finding progressive and sustainable solutions, including support, regularization, and of course marketing of their products, precisely so that they can deal with organized criminal syndicates that are trading on those minerals and extorting the miners and responsible for the terror in these communities.
I've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for your take there. Attorney at Lawyers for Human Rights, Mamet Lusibei there. Yeah, it's one of those stories, and I think we'll be here for a while to come. Hopefully, nobody finds themselves deceased in the entire process. So we'll be back in a minute.
Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.